We are recording another edition of No Filter Sports. Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, and Fred Heumann joining us today. And recording on a Tuesday morning. We apologize. We had some major issues with blackouts here in southeastern Detroit, some 350,000 homes. One of them was our esteemed producer, Brandon McAfee, whose power came back late Monday. And here we are trying to crank it out easy early Tuesday morning. Kind of a not the same quality sports day as a Monday, is it, guys? You know, fresh from the weekend, it's kind of a...
Yeah, well, you know, it's Monday, you're excited because you got all this stuff you want to talk about. And now it's Tuesday, and well, everybody's pretty much already talked about it, but we got plenty of things to discuss.
Yeah, and I want to start with obviously college football, which is runs deepest in our blood because we went to these schools, and that's why college sports is what it is, the great human drama. Michigan and Michigan State losing by a combined 73-11, maybe the two worst teams in the Big Ten. Don't really think we can argue with that. The last 2 weeks, they've lost by a combined 160-39. Michigan State is awful, and Michigan is awful also, but Michigan State of awfulness is more shocking for many reasons. Agreed?
Oh, God, yeah. This is a six-year Harbaugh's program. He was supposed to be contending for a national championship last year. You got to beat Ohio State first before you can talk about that. This whole thing is just an utter disaster.
Saturday was the most stunning Michigan result in my lifetime, and I'm not.
Nah, be careful about a couple of those losses a few years ago.
I'm not prone to the overstatement. I think this is bigger than Appalachian State, which is kind of an aberration.
Yep.
This is now the new culture of Michigan football. And to me, Saturday's game was a barometer of where this program is right now. And Saturday was an awful day for Michigan football, the worst I can remember in my lifetime. It was terrible.
Far worse than Appalachian State or Utah.
Now, come on, fellas. No, Appalachian State. No,
yeah, but
that's
that
the
was,
worst.
They were still that's good, and that was an
exactly.
upset, and that was an aberration.
Exactly. That was an outlier. This is not an outlier. In fact, before the game, on whatever the pregame show was, where Jack Nicklaus was the guest with Desmond Howard and Herb Street, and yeah, Desmond Howard predicted that Wisconsin would win the game, right. And Herb Street and was just aghast.
They were shocked.
Which also shows that the body of former players at Michigan don't feel any obligation to defend Harbaugh anymore.
They're pissed.
They are pissed. They are angry, and they are confused. And I've talked with several of them over the last few days, and I have given my theory that I think that Harbaugh is somewhere on the autism spectrum, which is a very wide spectrum. Autism goes from and I did a special, so I'm not a medical expert, and my opinion is not based on any science that I have studied or am I accredited to talk about, but I have done specials on autism. I did a half-hour thing I won an Emmy for, no bragging here, on autism years ago for Channel 7, believe it or not. And I want you to listen, and I got much anecdotal evidence on this. Listen to this answer that Jim Harbaugh gave. And this is a direct quote, okay? I didn't edit this. This is what he said when he was asked about the ramifications of the defeat. Play it, Brandon.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, every part is not close to where it should be.
That was that answer.
Eli, it sounds like a guy who just is so shell-shocked he doesn't know what to say. You talk to all these people. Have you talked to a single medical expert to confirm this? To have somebody else say, yeah,
no,
this
that's
guy
not my job. That's not my job.
You're the one making this charge.
I have doctors who have said that, and I'm not saying it. That's what I believe. I could be wrong. I've had several doctors talk to me about this from what they observe about him. I'll tell you a story, okay? Tyrone Wheatley was his running back coach, the great Tyrone Wheatley, who was also in 2015 and 2016 before Harbaugh. He didn't fire him. He offered him less money to come back the next year, so Wheatley quit. He was considered by many of the best recruiter in the country. There had been a game where he had read the riot act to the offense. They had come back in 2016 to win a game, and that's when Harbaugh started to kind of push him to the side. And Wheatley said to several of his former teammates, he goes, he's on all the time. There's no, he's never a regular person at some time. And that he kind of stares at you in ways that are very, very strange. And there is this he's not the only coach to say that he opens his mouth, his eyes are on fire, he's agape. He sometimes holds it for about 30 seconds without speaking, causing everyone to wonder what's flowing through his mind, if anything. So, you know, when you have mental illness, and again, it's just my opinion, it gets worse as you get older. Look what happened when he left San Francisco. I remember seeing an offensive lineman, I can't remember his name right now, just kind of laughing at how, is he serious? I mean, he treats us like we're children. This rah-rah stuff never ends. We're professionals. We know the game. This is our lives. We can manage ourselves. And the endless push. When he first came here, a bunch of former teammates to watch a practice in August before the season. And they said afterwards they were just jaw-dropping that the intensity was just beyond what you would expect. It was weird. It was strange. Here's another story. Frank Beamer tells this story. Remember Beamer?
Yeah, of course, the Virginia Tech coach. Yeah.
Okay. So they're going to play Stanford in the Orange Bowl in 2010. They're at an event at a restaurant. These are Beamer's words, okay? He says, after we take some pictures, we start talking, just the two of us. Jim says over and over how much respect he has for Georgia Tech. He must have said it five times. I'm looking at him like, are you serious? Finally, I'm joking with him, and I say, I can't wait to tell my team that you called us Georgia Tech because, you know, we are Virginia Tech. Beamer says, Harbaugh then threw his infamous shark expression at Beamer, as I just described, mouth agape, eyes on fire, looking poised to chomp. Okay, his assistants have talked about this for years. He holds it for about 30 seconds without speaking. Beamer continues to lock eyes with Harbaugh, waiting for him to say something, anything. It may have been the most uncomfortable silence of his life. Well, Harbaugh finally says, Beamer recalls, I can't wait to tell my players that you said we're going to play Samford, not Stanford. Then he turned and walked away.
Wow.
He told a story. Let me, one more story, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
When he was coaching out on the West Coast, He told people he was driving to work and noticed a traffic light wasn't working. Female cop standing in a busy intersection directing cars. She displayed such command of the intersection that Harbaugh pulled over, mesmerized. He tells the story for half an hour, sat in his car and studied the scene. He was so enthralled with the skill and the savvy of the traffic cop. He said, I like to watch people doing their job at the highest level. I really do. So he's strange. And players start to think, what's going on here? Who is he really? Well, how do I? And this is what.
He's strange. I mean, well, we all know that he's always been strange. But the stuff you're saying about the autism, you're talking about he's always on. How close are you and I? How close were you and I to Dick Vitale all those years? There's a guy who's always on. I don't think.
No, that's not true. Vitale, when he wasn't spewing to the public, could be very soft-spoken, very heartfelt. Well, he cried. Yeah. He was very emotional. Whereas Harbaugh is this, and he's the Rain Man, and he may be a genius when it comes to football, but in many ways, he's just could be a little bit
this
crazy.
Is something.
And what did Urban Meyer say over the weekend before the game? He said, a struggling team is created by one of three phenomenons. He talks about trust among players with each other or with the coaches. He talks about selfishness. And then he says, or a dysfunctional environment that spawns entitlement instead of hard work. So who knows what the players are thinking right now? Everyone knows these players are so much better than they're performing. This is a terrific football team that is playing like this. There's only one thing to point to. They don't understand this coach. They either don't believe in this coach or they're weirded out by this coach. And I think everybody is at this point. And this is a national story and nobody has said it this way. And I am stepping out on a limb, but I'm just an observer. I'm just an observer for all these.
I'm not here to question any of your conversations, Eli. And I think it's well-rounded and I think it's well thought out. And I think it's well investigated. I'm sitting here thinking, boy, if he just won a few more games, would we even be talking about this, right? It's a byproduct of this degree of losing. But I will say that I used to go to the Lloyd Carr press conferences, even from Lansing, and I stopped going to Harbaugh because of this strange behavior. This was long before this losing started. He has seemed out there. His responses to basic questions are strange. The stares that he gives to reporters, even he knows, were so strange to me. I ended up on the air at Channel 6 in Lansing just making fun of the guy, saying, "Will somebody please wake him up?" And I just refused to run a lot of the stuff because I wasn't that desperate for a 13-second soundbite that said absolutely nothing, and he just stared at the reporter like he was in outer space. So I'm not trying to lend credence to your theory on that. I'm just telling you that was my observation from a sportscaster in Lansing, and we covered Michigan, not like we covered Michigan State, but we did cover Michigan, and I just stopped going because they were so bizarre. His behavior was so bizarre.
Yeah, you guys, wow, this is some, this is really some stuff you're talking here. And Freddie, another thing that you mentioned before we started recording the show, I'd never thought of this either, the CTE issue. I mean, this guy was a great quarterback at Michigan, Captain Courageous in the NFL. Do you think this guy's been hit in the head so many times that he's no longer Jim Harbaugh?
I'm going to tell you, when I just to follow up what I just said, I used to wonder if there was some CTE here. I'm not here to say that there is. I'm just saying it caused me to wonder because I've known the guy since he was a player, and I've seen him off camera, including last year at the Juwan Howard introduction, and we talked, and he mentioned that he used to watch me on TV somewhere, and that wasn't true because at the time he couldn't have possibly seen me on TV, which is neither here nor there. He seemed normal, but his press conferences are bizarre. They're bizarre on the Mondays after the games. They're bizarre after the games when they play, and he just seems to stare out in outer space. And I'm trying to relate it to how, if he's this way with his players, how can they buy in and how can they relate? It's caused me to wonder for beyond the last year.
But Bob, let me just say, Bob, you know, I'm really glad you brought that up because CTE could be a part of it. Again, I'm not a doctor, and CTC could exacerbate whatever was there beforehand. It could be a combination. If you talk to mental health professionals, and as you know, my daughter suffered mental illness for many years, it's so complex. It can come from so many different directions. It's so hard to define. It could be a combination of many, many factors. But right now, what Fred said is true. And what I believe, just look at the performance on the field. These players are confused. They don't feel the sense of we're all in this together and we get it and we're communicating. We're on this mission together that we all believe. They're thinking, oh, there's some goofy stuff going on here.
Well, on that subject, Eli, two things about that really bothered me. We've discussed this before, how hollow it is with nobody at Michigan Stadium and the classic M Go Blue sign when the kids come out of the locker room, fired up, man, and everybody jumps up. Those kids were half-assed, pansy-ass, just kind of lumping up and just touching that maize and blue. I couldn't believe the lack of enthusiasm. And I saw something at the end of that game in the same vein that I have never seen before. On that last meaningless touchdown that Wisconsin scored, Michigan quit.
Yeah. Oh, God.
That Michigan defense quit. I've never seen a Michigan team quit.
When early in the game, when they ran it in from the 5-yard line and Wisconsin just pushed Michigan into the end zone, shortly after that, it was 21-20. Listen to what Kirk Herbstreit said at that point.
Where in the heck is the backbone and fight for Michigan?
Now, was that after that touchdown, Eli?
I believe, yes. And then they had a 3rd and 8 in their own territory. They handed the ball off to Haskins and got Charbonnet 1 or 2 yards. And Fowler says, that's the best play you can run.
The comment right before the one you just ran was, and I quote, I got this stuff written down watching the game. I can't believe this is Michigan. Early, wasn't it ironic? Early in the game, I saw Jimmy Leonard, because we covered the Jets, of course, and I watched the Jets play. I saw Jimmy Leonard play safety for the Jets, a terrific player. And these guys are already mentioning in the first half of this game, when you look at Leonard on the sidelines, the Wisconsin defensive coordinator, what a great assistant coach he is and what a great head coach he's going to be real soon. And I'm sitting there thinking, are Herbie and Chris Fowler kind of implying that Michigan should take a look at Jim Leonard? Is that what they were doing?
I don't know about
that. Well, I'm glad you brought up that last touchdown, Bob, because I was watching that. I said the same thing. I said, this is going to come up when we do this, which we thought was going to be a Monday. I said, they beyond quit. They laid down. They didn't even try to lay a hand on the running back. He walked through them as though the defense wanted the offense to score. You know, like in those situations,
we hope to get the ball back and score.
But it was a 35-point game. Yeah. And they absolutely laid down and let the guy walk through them untouched. And I thought to myself, He has completely lost this team. Mm-hmm. Now, I hate to take one little play late in the game to say he's lost this team, but I convinced myself there that they have no fight left for this coach. None.
Yeah, and you guys mentioned the Harbaugh press conferences, the news conferences. So on Monday, guess what else has cropped up now? A classic quarterback controversy. He doesn't know who's playing this weekend against Rutgers. And if Michigan should somehow lose to bleeping Rutgers, if this were professional sports, Harbaugh would be fired after the game. And I wonder what's going to happen.
Everyone knows that he must go. I think that's obvious. And by the way, Muschamp, what's his first name?
Will
got fired. They owe him 15
at South Carolina.
Million,
he did
$15 million. They owe him. Yeah. Harbaugh, they owe for half of this season, and of course next. But as Urban Meyer said, when you hear about a top team struggling, it's not bad players. Something is wrong. So do you sit through this, whatever is wrong, or do you cut bait with Harbaugh and make Josh Gattis the coach for the rest of the season? And then give, by the way, I'm told by former players that Michigan recruiting is hemorrhaging. Absolutely
sure.
People are decommitting and not going, and so how long do you stick with something where everyone knows this isn't working, this guy's gonna go, and the longer you keep him, the worse it is.
Well,
I've said all along you don't replace a coach in the middle of the season, but as you speak, Eli, I'm thinking to myself exactly what you're saying. If recruiting is indeed hemorrhaging, and how could it not be with the way they're playing and some of his behavior, then at least you need to make a statement to the nation that we're not going to continue in this direction. Whether it's Josh Gattis, whether it's Eli Zarrett or Bob Page,
you're
not continuing this direction. And so you give a statement to the recruiting world out there that we are heading in a new direction and there's no sense waiting any. It's not about Josh Gattis.
I agree 100%.
It's about the direction you're going.
Yeah. Now, the weird thing, I want you guys to think about this. Folks out there in the audience, think about this. The weird thing is how it's gotten to this point.
Let's back up.
Let me remind you, in Harbaugh's first head coaching job, he was 11-1 in back-to-back seasons to San Diego. In 2010, he led Stanford to a 12-1 record while finishing with the number 4 ranking in the country. His 49ers were a pair of fumbled punts away from reaching the Super Bowl the next year. 2012 season, 49ers were 5 yards from scoring the go-ahead touchdown in the final minutes of the Super Bowl. The next season, Eli, he reached the NFC Championship for a third straight year. And now, what the hell has happened?
But he's left every one of those teams, and it just can't last. So anyway, Ward Manuel, who's a bright man, good athletic director, Mark Schlissel, who's a brilliant
knows nothing brilliant, about football whatsoever.
Doesn't matter. But they know about people. Ward Manuel knows about football, knows about dynamics of a team, and they've thought about all of this. And yes, depending on what happens at Rutgers, it could get even more interesting.
Okay, before we go to the commercial break here, I want to ask you. I know you got to go break. Those religious people who wear those WWJD, what would Jesus do bracelets? Mm-hmm. Nobody's brought this up in this situation now. What would Don Canham do?
I was going to say, what would Ward Manuel, which would make a WWWM, but even more.
You know what I'm saying? Would Canham put up with this, or would he have fired Harbaugh?
It's such a different era. So hard to say. Anyway, so many people over 45, like me, who lose their close vision, get multifocal lens implants. I got them a couple of years ago, the end of 2018. I see the tiniest of print. I see perfectly at a distance. I will never need glasses of any kind again. It's life-changing and lifetime-lasting procedure, and you can get it from Dr. Yaldo. Of course, Dr. Yaldo is also Michigan's leading LASIK surgeon, a different surgery for people under 45 that enables them to also, once and for all, throw those contacts and glasses in the garbage. These surgeries are the safest with the fewest side effects in all of medicine. You can get a free evaluation. It costs nothing to find out which procedure that you allow Dr. Yaldo to do will change your life in ways you can only imagine. Call 1-800-398-EYES or go to YaldoEyeCenter.com. Tell them No Filter Sports sent you. You'll save $1,500 off the regular price. And everyone in Michigan knows Lincoln's legacy of luxury cars. I've been buying my Lincolns at Star Lincoln for the last 6 cars. I don't know how many years it is, probably 12 or 15 years. In buying a Lincoln Hoot McInerney Star, you find both the buying and service elements to be as hassle-free and friendly as you can imagine. It's why Star is Michigan's premier Lincoln dealership, an exemplary family business started by Hoot years ago, over half a century ago. They get five-star reviews right and left because the experience there is the best. Drive the Star of American Auto Luxury. That's a Lincoln. That's Star Lincoln. Make an appointment online at starlincoln.com. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. I suppose we should talk about our friends up in East Lansing who are similarly suffering, however, it's a new regime under Mel Tucker, and they're in the evaluation stage. They got a lot to evaluate, including quarterback. My goodness.
Yeah, better believe it. Let's just forget for a minute the Michigan game. We know how horrendous Michigan is now. Fred Heumann and I together on this show, what was it, just 3-4 weeks ago, something like that, agreed Rocky Lombardi may be the greatest kid in the world, and he's a great athlete, and he's a tough kid, Iowa State wrestling champion, but he is not a quarterback. And he has now shown that. He was horrendous. As you know, they took him out and replaced him with Peyton Thorne in Saturday's game. And I'm sitting there watching this thing, watching this lack of enthusiasm, again, by Michigan State, though not as bad as Michigan. And I'm thinking to myself, when Indiana goes up 24-0 in the second quarter, that all my fellow Michigan State alumni sitting up there back home, get your butts off the couch, get your asses out in the yard, and start raking the leaves, which is what you should be doing, because this game is over 24-0 in the second quarter, and it was.
I thought 24-0 was being kind to Michigan State. I didn't think the game was nearly that close. And then you combine that with Michigan. They're both 1-3 now. They're both lethargic. They are both looking for quarterbacks. Both of their coaches have no idea who their quarterback is right now. It's such a parallel that it's astounding. And if you haven't seen enough of Joe Milton by now, you've certainly seen enough of Rocky Lombardi to know that he's not the answer. So the question becomes then who, and I suggested to you, Bob, before the season, that if Rocky Lombardi is the starter, they're probably in trouble. I don't mean to knock the kid, but
if
he was good enough, he would have saw more quality time in the last quarterback regime, and he didn't. And so you thought you had seen Theo Day in high school, and he's not even the number two right now.
No, I've never seen Theo Day throw a football. I'd like to. He's 6 feet six.
So, Bob, you even thought that Theo Day was the logical backup, and I had no reason to disagree with you. And
big
here
secret.
They go to the backup.
Another Mel Tucker, big
not
secret.
Not even Theo Day. So he's now running number three.
Right.
And he was a terrific high school quarterback in Michigan. So where does this team go now with its quarterback situation? I could ask the same question of Michigan. Both of their starters, who allegedly earned this opportunity, look ill-fit to run this offense in both cases. And so both teams are lost. I can't remember a time when Michigan and Michigan State were both so bad and beyond bad, hopeless moving forward.
And let the record indicate that I already, in a Twitter conversation this week, used the name Mel Tucker in the same context as Bobby Williams and John L. Smith. I didn't like this hire, 5-7 at Colorado in his only year as a head coach. He lied about leaving there. They gave him too much money. He was not their first choice. I don't like what I'm seeing.
But seriously, he's got much better credentials than Bobby Williams or Muddy Waters or who else did you mention?
That's another good one. I use that
name
too.
John L. Smith.
I mean, he's been a pro coach for many, many years. Mel Tucker's got a very impressive resume, and he's brand new on the job, and obviously he didn't inherit a great team. The big difference here is that Mel Tucker still may turn it around, and we know that Jim Harbaugh, who's been recruiting for years with better players, is not going to turn it around, and I'm waiting for Bob to start calling it the Big 12 plus Michigan and Michigan State.
The question is,
which one do you say last?
That's about it.
Could even plus Michigan State and Michigan,
I was thinking about that over the weekend. Now, we don't know if State's going to play because Maryland has had all these COVID-19 problems.
Yeah, they didn't practice on Monday.
Michigan got
week.
Rutgers coming up. You know, there's never been a Saturday in my life, I don't think, for many, many, many years, where I did not watch Michigan and Michigan State play. But guess what, fellas? We got 4-0 Northwestern hosting Wisconsin Saturday. We got at noon Indiana, obviously the surprise team in college football.
What's the line on that?
At Ohio State.
What's the line on that?
I may watch those games instead. Ohio State's got to be a pretty big favorite.
I would love for it. I told you, I'm adopting Indiana. By the way, we talked about Michigan's epic loss, and I agree with Fred on that, the worst of all time, at least since in the 52 years that I've been in Ann Arbor and around here. It was the first shutout loss Michigan State had in 35 years. Is that even possible?
You could go on.
35 years? Meanwhile, I would just like to say about Michigan State that we have a great guest coming up who had one of the greatest performances in Michigan State history when he intercepted 4 passes in one game against my Wolverines.
Oh, I remember that.
Well, that's John Miller.
You know, Eli, and I'll mention this to John just to stroke him off on the show. Well, not in the literal sense, in the figurative sense, if you look at John Miller's career at Farmington Hills Harrison, how great he was as a two-way player, you're looking at arguably the greatest high school football player the state of Michigan ever produced. Now, that's a heavy thing to say.
Yeah, I read a Mick McCabe article I researched, and he had him 20th all time in Michigan.
Yeah, talking all around.
Well, he ran for 4,500 yards.
Yeah. 4,500 yards on offense and had 20 interceptions.
20 interceptions, what record still said. I just love him with that big square jaw. What a nice kid. What a great kid.
Yeah, he really is.
On this show from that 87 George Perlis Dynamo team that went to the Rose Bowl.
I was there. Yep.
As was I.
I wasn't. Yep. Anyway, it's just we had Lorenzo White, who was just named to the College Football Hall of Fame. And who else do we have on that show, on our show from that team, Bob? Can you remember?
We had Todd Crum.
There you go, Todd Crum, who had 2 interceptions in that game.
Yeah, right? Now a detective with the West Bloomfield Police. Before we leave college football, I do have to mention my boy. I'm sorry, fellas, but old Tommy's back in the news right here. Now, having recently been elected a senator from the sovereign foreign nation of Alabama, during the campaign, y'all know I said this, old Tommy refused to debate his opponent or take any position on no issues. The only political comment he made was to say, and I quote, "I thank God that he sent us Donald Trump." So did y'all see this story?
What are you talking
about? The other day, old Tommy incorrectly identified.
Old Tommy who? Old Tommy who?
Tommy Tuberville.
Well, you didn't mention his last name. Okay.
He's a senator. He incorrectly identified the 3 branches of the United States government and also incorrectly said the United States fought socialism in World War II.
Oh,
this is
my
a United
God.
States senator. This is a U.S. God. Senator. Socialism, the root of all evil, according to people like Tommy Tuberville, while we older Americans like Eli Zaret and myself are so thankful every day for socialism in the form of our Social Security and our Medicare.
That's all I got to say about that. Make that 3 of us. I'm old too.
You got your socialism security yet, Freddie? That's a big deal. It's a beautiful thing.
It is.
What was I going to say here? Oh, too bad we don't have Larry Sorensen here on the show because his team, Wake Forest, led by 21 over North Carolina, that then came back and beat.
And it was going to be a great game, and it was. And I think Larry should be. We'll get his ass next time he's on the show. But I think Larry should be proud because his Wake Forest team actually held Carolina under 50 points.
How about that?
Very impressive. And was it 50
to?
Was it a 49 to 40?
No, it was 59 to something.
Oh, under 60 points. I'm going to say.
But they did hold quarterback Sam Howell to just 550 yards passing for 7 touchdowns.
It's a new wave of college football, gang. It's just a different game.
And it's a different game. But now what's happening in the pros is they're taking guys like Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray and letting them and fashioning pro offenses around the way they played in college, saying, let's let these kids be these kids. And certainly you all saw on Sunday night the amazing. So my question would be, who was more amazing? Kyler Murray going to his left, dodging a tackle.
I know what you're going to say. In Kyler
falling out of bounds.
Right.
Throwing it against the grain. Right. 50 yards in the air where DeAndre Hopkins leaps and makes the catch between
Bills
defenders.
Yes, here's why I said that. Because all these athletic guys back there leaping for that ball, DeAndre Hopkins was just the best leaper by a little bit. There's only one place that he can throw that ball, and that's 6 inches higher than the other guys can leap. And he did. This kid isn't actually like a water bug. I mean, you can't catch him. He's flitting all over the field. He can throw. He can run. And I'll tell you what, he's on national TV in the Thursday night game. I'm going to watch that game because I want to see him play.
He is worth whatever price there is to watch him, which is free for us. sort of free. But at any rate, I understand your fascination, Eli, with his rollout and that pass, and he is a special talent. But I have a no-brainer answer to your question. And to me, the more impressive thing was DeAndre Hopkins going up and getting that ball.
Yeah.
And I can't even fault the defenders. Normally at Hail Marys, I say, why don't the defenders just go up and knock it down? They tried. They couldn't, and this guy outleaped them and grabbed the ball, and I'm sitting there thinking, no wonder Bill O'Brien lost his job. How can you trade this guy him? Yeah.
Freddie, he outleaped him by 6 inches, and if that ball is thrown inches higher, it's incomplete.
He didn't outleap them. He outtimed them. They were coming down. They hadn't started up. They can all leap. They're all great athletes. Except there's a reason why some play offense and some play defense. Because the ones on offense know how to catch the damn ball.
I'm not knocking the throw. The throw was great. It makes me want to watch this kid even more.
But the
catch was even greater. The catch was unbelievable.
All right, you know what this is? Tastes great, less filling. That's what this argument is. I want to tell you right now, though, about David Hall Mortgage, as I frequently do. You know, rates are still at all-time lows. And if your current mortgage rate is above 3.9%, Hall Financial's asking you guys, what are you waiting for? You could be saving money. At Hall Financial right now, almost 70% of all loans don't even require an appraisal. If for some reason your loan does, for this month of November only, Hall Financial will pay that appraisal charge for you, up to $500. Remarkably, closing times have now sped up even more than when Eli had his mortgage redone recently with them. At the moment, the majority of loans at Hall Financial are closing in just 10 or fewer business days. So just go to our No Filter Sports Podcast website and click on the Hall Financial link to get started. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, and more personal attention. Let Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies help you plan when you get your mortgage redone for your future family obligations and your own retirement. With his track record of success and decades of experience as a financial advisor, this enables Luke to help create custom solutions for you or your business. You want to call him? I'm going to give you the number again, 248-663-4748, and set up a complimentary consultation. Won't cost you a dime. Then if you feel comfortable, let Luke Nowacki do his thing by laying out a plan that fits your individual needs. He's ethical. He's knowledgeable. He's caring. Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. Again, the number to call is 248-663-4748. Advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Fellas, now, wait, I got a news item for you boys. Just a news item. Moments after Graham Gano kicked two more field goals as the Giants defeated the Eagles 27-17 on Sunday, the Giants announced it had extended Gano's contract through 2023, 3 years, $14 million. And I mention this because other than a quarterback, the kicker is the most important player on any football team because they win or lose games all by themselves. And how about Matt bleeping Prater?
They don't get paid as much, but yeah, Prater's amazing.
Prater's the best player on the Lions.
Oh, my God.
And he saved their bacon. That and the roughing the passer call saved their bacon, and he comes in from 59 and wins them a game. My question for you guys is, how many Lion diehards really want them to win? Because now here they are 4-5, right? And they are kind of on the – maybe not the thick of the playoff race.
They're two games out, they're in the outskirts of being
a contender. And you look at their schedule now, what do they have in the next three? They have the Panthers, winnable and losable. The Texans, winnable and losable.
You know, McCaffrey's not going to play in that game. The Panthers have some injuries, and McCaffrey's not going to play that game.
So the Lions could go into Carolina and win. Now they're 5-5. Then they get the hapless Texans at home. Now that's Thanksgiving Day. Now they could be 6-5. And my question is, do you want them to win these games?
Oh, come on. Let Brandon, you ask Brandon that. Ask Brandon that, because he is the Lions.
You want Matt Patricia back next year?
But then they're
7-5.
Then they're 7-5 after they beat the Bears after that, who lost Nick Foles last night. Mitch Trubisky's got a bad shoulder. They're down to a third string.
It's getting scary if you want a new coach, because he could save his job here in the last half of the
Brandon.
Season.
I can't believe that Bob Quinn is still here. So I don't know. Every win to me seems like an extension for Quinn and for Patricia. And yeah, to tell you the truth, I don't believe that they can win. I don't care how many years they have to do so. So I would love them to lose a few games to the point where Sheila Fordham blows them out and puts in her own people.
Well, Freddie,
that's really an interesting comment from you. I would bet that your viewpoint is in the minority, because most people who still do root for the Detroit Lions are such wackos. They just want them to win.
Yep.
Well, that's just being a fan.
That's interesting that you would say that, though,
Brandon. It's still my team. I mean, I'm still going to always root for them. But like I said, every single win that they pull out is just extending the tenure of these two, and I don't have faith in them.
Look, they could go to 7-5 by beating Carolina, Houston, and Chicago. That's still a stretch. But then they finish with four tough games. The Packers, they're at Tennessee. They got Tampa Bay and Minnesota, which is improving. So they could – whatever. You know what? It was a meaningless game. Even though they're 14.
No game is meaningless. The 0-9 Jets went into the weekend with a chance to make the playoffs.
All right. Let's move on from football if we can, because there's a couple other things.
Well, I just want to say this, though, Eli. You know, I have a mea culpa here, kind of, and you'll be shocked at this. I watched Sunday's game, and I thought that was one of the greatest, most entertaining games I've seen in the Lions game. And I thought it was fantastic. And all those typical Lions mistakes down the end, this is how they're going to blow it. You know, when they stop them on 4th-and-4, tweet pass interference. Right. And when the Lions can win the game, and there he's wide open, he's streaking for the end zone. Stafford is back to throw a long one down the field, and Quintel Cephas can't get it. He overthrows him. Yeah. And then to see Prater quick that field goal, and I was kind of pulling for the Lions. Yes, I just said that, folks. I just thought it was very entertaining. I really did.
Prater was an underdog. He had a serious drinking problem. The Broncos cut him.
Do you remember he started with the Lions? A lot of people don't know that. He started with the Lions. Matt Prater did. They brought him into camp, and they let him go because they had a guy named Jason Hansen who was their kicker.
Well, he's a good story. Another good story, if we can move around here a little bit in the world of sports, is Kim Ng, a diminutive woman, Chinese and Thai descent, also with a very tiny five-letter name. That's a very short first and last name. But she's 51 years old, taking a giant leap for women in sports. She's the Marlins general manager, first woman to hold a position that would stun the great old school GMs. Remember the old school GMs? We were kids, Buzzy Bavese and Bing Devine and Branch Rickey. And now Dave Dombrowski out of work, Kim Ng in play. She also
Come on, Dave's down in he's trying to bring a Major League Baseball franchise down.
Yeah,
in Nashville,
but that's a
long. He's not out of work.
That's a long. Yeah. He's out of work as a general manager since the Red Sox let him go. That's all I'm needing to say. But you know, and at the risk of being guilty of racial stereotypes, Ng's, who's Chinese and Thai descent, as I said, her parents were a financial analyst and a banker. You know, being a GM now is a math job. It's not a player job. It's a math job. And can I say that an Asian rising to a math-based job shouldn't be shocking to all of us? Right. But it still is, because she is a woman.
But you know what? I'm glad you're bringing this topic up, because you know what's shocking to me? I wonder if you guys agree. You don't watch a football game now at the NFL or college level without one of the officials running around the field and a ponytail bobbing outside of her cap. And you know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I'm sure they must be good, or they wouldn't have been given this opportunity. But do we have to have women officials? Does that make it PC somehow? It's kind of a man's it's kind of weird. Well, I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, you know.
I understand what you're saying. It's a little strange, and we're talking about you mentioned those those general managers in baseball, Eli, and those are guys that were all considered, you know, racist and anti-sexist and whatnot. That's the reality of it. And now
wait. Just because Al Campanis went on Ted Koppel's show and said blacks do not have the necessary buoyancy to know how to swim.
He wasn't a general manager.
It's unbelievable. How could he not lose his job? But I guess I noticed the flopping hair at the officials, and I guess because I brought attention to it to myself, I'm saying, wow. I said the same thing you said. She must be good because she's not being noticed for anything she did wrong, although Bill Belichick rang her up a few times on calls on the sidelines. But yeah, it's and it goes into Eli's point on this topic about how I guess we are moving forward as a society where we don't think it's absolutely unbelievably stunning that a woman is going to run a Major League Baseball team. And I think that's progress.
I'm sorry, Freddie. I thought it was.
She's good.
You thought it was stunning?
Yes.
She's good, and the
not saying she's not good. I don't know,
but look at all the this is the sexism that's within all of us to a degree as men growing up in a time where women were not allowed to do these things, they're good, and there are some very good female sports writers. We never thought that could be. You got your Christine Brennans, etc., who are outstanding. You got some very good, very talented women broadcasters, and that was all male jobs, like Chet Huntley and Walter Cronkite. You got them hosting the news. You got some, it's prejudice to think that she's there not because she's a woman. She's a referee because she passed the test. She went and she outcompeted the other guys. There was a time you couldn't imagine a woman in an army. So we're all kind of
Viola Palmer kind of, greased the skids on this one for everybody, because once she made the NBA, we kind of got used to it. And I think Violet was at least a decent official. But fellas, there's a story that's just about as big as baseball, even though it does come up every year. And it leads to all these kinds of bar arguments. And my guess right now is that all four of us here are going to be in agreement on this. The new Hall of Fame candidates have now been announced, and the top vote, there's nobody who's a new candidate this year who deserves enshrinement. So you look at the guys who've come close. Kurt Schilling has been the closest at 70%, but this is his ninth year of eligibility. What, he's not a Hall of Famer for 9 years, and suddenly he is? He probably gets in. I don't think so. I don't think Bonds and Clemens, other top voters, should get in. But I want you to consider the case here of Omar Vizquel. Do you realize this guy played 24 years in the big leagues?
Omar Vizquel.
24 years in the big leagues, 2,800 hits. He won 11 gold gloves. And if you go to baseballreference.com to see the players he is most closely compared to in terms of stats, the top three, number one, as George used to say, Little Louie. Louie Aparicio. Then Rabbit Moranville, number two. And believe it or not, Ozzy, number three. All three of those guys are in the Hall of Fame. So my thing is, if Alan Trammell, whom we love, is in the Hall of Fame, I think Omar Vizquel has got to be in the Hall of Fame. I think he's the one guy who should make it.
I would look up, the stat that I always go to, whether it's valid or not, is war. War is something that can compare all players. And right. So, the guys up, the top candidates this year are Torrey Hunter, Mark Burley, LaTroy Hawkins, guys like that.
They're not Hall of Famers.
Now, Burley's war was 59, which is pretty big. That puts him at 200th all time. In war. A Hunter is 50. Norm Cash was 52. And Norm Cash isn't a Hall of Famer, but Hunter may get in because he played 19 years. Another reason why I support your thing with Vizquel, to play 24 years alone is astounding. And yet you got guys like Bonds and Clemens who are fourth and eighth all time in war.
Never.
117. Bonds is 162. He's three behind Babe Ruth.
Tough noogies.
You aren't going to agree with me, Bob, and this is opening a new can of worms that we shouldn't even open today, but I'm with Sparky Anderson. If Peter Edwards Rhodes and Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens aren't in the Hall of Fame, you might as well burn the place down.
There are reasons they aren't.
I know there are reasons there aren't, and they're probably legitimate reasons.
But they're not the same, Freddie.
They're Hall of Famers.
Freddie, two of those three guys cheated. One
they're
did not.
Hall of
Rose,
Famers.
Rose
they were
cheat.
Hall of Famers without the cheating, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, they are. You're right, Eli. So why did they do it? I've never understood that. They are Hall of Famers without the cheating. Why did they do it?
We don't have time today for an argument. Right. I listened to your last show with Bob Denny and Larry Sorensen, and when you went through your tired refrain about how can you turn down 18 points?
Oh, stop it. Then let's move on.
Oh, my God. How can you turn that down?
One of the guys in the mailbag today said, Bob, you're totally right. One of the guys in the mailbag today said, Bob,
I don't give a crap what anybody says in the mail.
Let's move on. Get off it then.
I'll ask you a question, Bob, okay?
I don't want to talk about it.
Baseball does $10 billion in business. The owners get about half, and the players get about half. So if you want the players to take less, what do you do with the extra money? Do you lower the ticket prices all around baseball? Is that what you do? Do the owners and players agree to
– Are you saying the owners are making money? They're making money?
Aren't they making money?
No. Most of them aren't. They're not making money in baseball.
Oh, I feel so bad for the owners who don't make money.
I don't feel bad for them. They're multi-billionaires.
Yeah. In any case, okay. We'll save that for another time.
Freddie, how long have you and I known Eli Zerr? In my case, 45 years. One of his favorite things in all of life, and it goes for many other people too, is G-O-L-F. We're almost done with this show, and he hasn't mentioned the Masters.
I was waiting for one of you guys to bring up the Masters.
By the way, I read some of the comments in the mailbag, and they're laughing, saying, well, there's no rough at the Masters. Yes, there is rough at the Masters. This year there is rough, and that's why Bryson DeChambeau, who I said along with Denny, would not win the tournament, and he had no shot, and he did finish quite a bit back, got his ball lost in the rough and couldn't find it.
That was unbelievable.
I said Tiger Woods had no chance either. He had the 10, which I feel very, very bad about. But, you know, people are lauding Tiger because after the 10, he birdied 5 of the last 6 holes and finished at 1 over. If he hadn't gotten the 10, he'd have finished, it was 1 under. He finished at -8, which would have put him in the hunt. So, but then again, I don't credit him that much for coming back because, you know, when you play golf, Fred, once you played so crappy and you can't win, you're relaxed, start hitting the ball better, and start getting better shots.
And there's something to that.
Which was Tiger Woods did the last few holes. But, you know, it was what got me was I really noticed that there were no people there. And, you know, you can't call them people. You can't call them fans. You can't call them spectators. You got to call them patrons. But, you know, in the Masters, maybe they are patrons because you think it's the same people every year. They support this. They're part of it. And to not see people there was one of the weird. I got used to it in baseball. I've gotten used to it in football. I could not watch the Masters a moment without thinking, where are the people? This is weird.
How about the final day when Tiger walked up 18 and the commentators were speculating what a moment this would be when the defending champion comes up 18 to get his salute and Tiger's just looking around and there's nobody there. That was a weird, eerie moment for me.
And what was weird the day before, Fred, on number 12, the day before, he hits a great tee, still in contention, hits a great tee shot within 15 feet, sinks the putt, dead silence. That place would have gone crazy. And I just noticed, I like golf and I'm able to watch all of it without spectators. Oh, pardon me, patrons. But this was weird.
Yeah, it was strange.
And Dustin Johnson is so good, it's scary.
Yeah, well, you take that. You take the lack of patrons at the Masters this year. You take the fact that one of the most beautiful golf courses in the world, if not the most beautiful, was devoid of all those amazing blooms and blossoms and flowers and everything's kind of gray. You take the fact that they're playing it after golf season is over and up against college football in the NFL. Fellas, I'm kind of a golf fan. I didn't watch. I'd like to see the TV ratings on this to see how many people watch that instead of the NFL on Sunday.
You're just kind of a golf fan.
I am.
Big golf fans watch the golf.
I know that. How many of you are there? Freddie, did you watch the NFL Sunday or the Masters?
I watched both. And they had the Masters starting early, and that's why.
Because
they had 4 o'clock football on CBS.
I watched the Dolphins at 4.
Yeah, I did watch. I did watch golf, and I thought of you, Bob, when the commentators were saying that Dustin Johnson now has the biggest prize in golf, and they thought they were talking about the Masters Trophy, and he walks off with Paulina Gretzky. Bob Page is sitting there. Hey, fellas, I'm sorry. He already had the biggest prize in golf, and he's going home with her.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Yeah. I didn't really. So if I may, I'm not going to use a vulgarity on this program, so I'm going to use a euphemism. I believe it is time for Tiger Woods to defecate or leave the restroom, if you understand what I mean.
I don't understand what you mean.
I'm not going to say you know what or get off the pot.
I don't know what you mean.
This guy, you're telling us on this show that Tiger had no chance to win because he's not playing enough. Because he's not, said that, because he doesn't play enough.
But he's still a great golfer.
Does he still want to play or not? Brandon wants
us
to go.
What? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Because after a 10 on that hole, how you humiliating.
It's every time he tees it up, Bob, please. I stop what I'm doing to watch.
Okay.
He just won last year.
Eli, say goodbye to the people in Toledo.
Yes. So long, everybody in Toledo on WCW. I appreciate you listening to us. You've been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. No, you don't tell him to. He shouldn't retire.
I'm not telling him anything. How embarrassing was that, though?
It's one hole, Bob. It can happen to anybody. He shot one. He shot without that hole. He shoots 8 under par at Augusta National. That is greatness. He is still a great player.
No, just that's goodness. That's goodness.
But Bob, those. I hadn't seen that hole live. So I thought, oh my gosh, Tiger hit in the water 3 times. If you saw the shots, he hit the green and they rolled back and the second fell in the water. So it's not like he's plunking it in the water. No. Okay.
And then he had an impossible bunker shot.
It's not John Vandeveld, okay? Yeah. He hit shots that he should. He's a professional golfer, but they rolled off the green back into the water twice. And the third one, he chunked a sand wedge that went into the water on the other side.
When it comes to golf, I'm the one just asking the questions. You guys are the experts.
He's, he can't play as often. He has physical problems. He had 4 serious back operations, but he's 45 years old. In 5 years, he's going to be on the senior tour winning everything if his back holds up. And he's still able to compete. He just can't play often enough to be the Tiger. And his body doesn't let him be the Tiger.
His health doesn't allow him to play often enough.
Hey, Feldman Automotive is Michigan's number one Chevy dealer. They got 5 locations: Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, Highland. They've got 9 locations in all, including Hyundai of New Hudson, Kia of Novi, Feldman Dodge Jeep and Ram of Woodhaven, and of course, Michigan's number one pre-owned super center in Waterford, known simply as 1-800-PRE-OWNED. You buy a fully inspected and guaranteed pre-owned auto from Feldman, and you'll also get the drive it for 3 days, love it or bring it back, guarantee. You can't go wrong there. And you're guaranteed credit approval. Crazy how good that is. You can find just what you're looking for at one of Feldman's 9 locations. Their massive inventory is unmatched in Metro Detroit. Of course, you can buy online at FeldmanAuto.com with an effortless, hassle-free experience. And Power Home Solar, America's fastest growing solar energy company. It's based right here in Metro Detroit. Every one of its panels, state of the art they are, made in America. You save money, you save the environment, and you never suffer a costly power outage again because they've partnered with Generac, which is the nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. So you're protected. You'll never get those awful power outages again. Power Home Solar is financing starting at $99 a month. Call it 1-800-POWER-90. Save an additional $2,000.
We got to get to John, Eli. We got so much to talk about here. Tuesday morning as we record this, Wednesday night is the NBA draft. And the Pistons are picking number 7. Among the number 7 picks in the past decade, there have been no NBA All-Star selections, just to remind you. Pistons did get Greg Monroe in 2010 with a 7th pick. Yeah, I liked him. Never understood why they just let him go via free agency to Milwaukee, but maybe they saw something we didn't. Because Greg Monroe, I don't know if you know this, he's only 30, but he's playing in Russia now. Now, Troy Weaver, the new GM, has made his first trade. On the surface, I don't know. I didn't like it because I like Bruce Brown of Detroit, traded him to the Nets. They got a number 2 pick. And so, you know, one of these,
you know,
big
Bob,
European
Bob,
kids.
Well, you know, with all due respect, I appreciate the update. Personally, I find the Pistons so utterly uninteresting until they can do something again.
I know.
And even look remotely like a .500 team. I just don't pay any attention. I don't care who they draft, what they do, when they do it, who they trade, where they play, what's going on. Just show me something.
Okay.
Unless they're good, they are a total non-entity in this town.
I understand. Zero. I respect that. So let's quickly move on to something else.
Let me just throw in. I, too, appreciate Bob's attention to detail and covering everything we can. But I'm thinking Bruce Brown. There are at least 75 Bruce Browns in that league, right?
Nah, that kid plays
there
hard.
There are at least 75
they
Bruce
play
Browns
hard.
In that league.
He's a good kid, and he plays hard at
maybe,
both ends.
But there's, there's 75 others like him.
To right, quote the great Rasheed Wallace, both teams played hard.
All right, so let me ask you guys this then, so you don't want to talk about testaments. I'm not sure what to think about this because he's 35 years old, but the great headed for the Hall of Fame, Chris Paul, has now just been traded. Mm-hmm. He goes to Phoenix, which is going to be an entertaining team. We heard so much about Ricky Rubio coming over from Spain. To me, he's a nice player, but he's never been great. He's a huge package going back, so there are going to be a lot of deals coming up here.
I thought the biggest one is that James Harden is trying to angle to go to New Jersey. Play with Kyrie and Durant. That would be fascinating.
Well, all I got to say is this. You're originally from Nutley, New Jersey. I wonder if James Harden has ever been to New Jersey. Because if he has, he wouldn't want to go to New Jersey.
Oh, Jersey's beautiful.
Except that they're in Brooklyn now.
It's the Garden State.
They're not in New Jersey anymore. They're in Brooklyn now.
Beautiful.
That's different.
And by the way, Nutley, New Jersey, home of Martha Stewart.
I did not know
that. It was in my big brother's graduating class from Nutley High.
Hey, I want to mention this because I know a lot of people watch this along with me. Last Thursday show, as a matter of fact, I said that ESPN2 was televising a high school basketball exhibition game. Well, the reason they did was because of Amani Bates of Ypsilanti, who'd already been on the cover of Sports Illustrated at age 15 as the next LeBron. I had never seen him play before this, scored 36 points. But his Ipsy Prep Academy team lost 78-71 to a Minnesota high school team, which has the top prep player in America this year, the senior. This kid's name, folks, is Chet Holmgren. 7 foot center. He had 31 points, 13 boards, 6 blocks.
Where's he going to college?
Believe it or not, he might be leaning to Michigan. Tom Izzo is not in on this kid. He's one of those big.
Don't they got another 7 footer? That's going to.
I'm telling you, though, this kid, Chet Holmgren, you can't judge a player on one game, but he had perhaps the greatest single game I've ever seen a high school player play. And I was the first person to ever put Irvin Johnson on TV or radio. You watch this guy, Chet Holmgren. And, of course, Bates was great, but he didn't play a lot of defense, took a lot of wild shots, scored 36 points.
What you're saying, Bob, is that Michigan is a great basketball school.
You better believe it. You better believe it. And what I said on the last show you weren't on is this war, I don't think Tom's going anywhere, this war between Juwan and Tom, Michigan State is the next Duke Carolina of college basketball. It's going to be amazing to watch.
I'm up for that.
Of course, everybody saw this last week that the NFL lost one of the greatest players ever in Paul Hornung, and everybody knows about that. But locally, we also lost Terry Durod, age 64, former University of Detroit star, former Boston Celtic, great guy, Detroit fireman when his career had ended. And it just, this was so shocking to so many of us. My heart bleeds, especially for Earl Cureton. He said they were like brothers. And we got to do a necrology, folks. And sometimes they hurt more than other times.
Durod was 64, died of leukemia. And it just shows because he was in amazing shape. He played basketball, I think, up until the last few days. He was a lifetime gym rat. Paul Hornung, man, the golden boy. Boy, oh boy, what a story. I mean, as a kid watching him and his Packers destroy my New York Giants in the NFL championship game in 61 and 62. Lombardi's Packers were the legendary team in football history. changed the way the game was played. We're on the cusp of when the leagues merge and the first Super Bowl they played in the first two. And Horning, with that, who was a college quarterback at Notre Dame, is the halfback. Jim Taylor, the fullback. Bart Starr. Those were some.
You're from New York. For those of us who are from Detroit, we watched them destroy the Lions. Oh, that was the rivalry. Green Bay and those guys against the Detroit Lions, and we'll never forget seeing all those games.
This day in sports. Let's see. This day in 53, the St. Louis Browns became what team, gentlemen? The St. Louis Browns became what team in 1953?
Well, that would be the Baltimore Orioles.
That is correct, the Baltimore Orioles. This day in 66, Sandy Koufax retired in the prime of his career, not even 30 years old. I think he'd won 27 games that year, but it was an arthritic elbow. Roger Clemens won the AL MVP in 86. I guess he won the Cy Young, too, that year. And in 87, George Bell won the MVP for the Blue Jays when we fought Alan Trammell, who had an 8.3 WAR to Bell's 5 WAR. And Trammell hit .343. A tough choice, but Bell had a great year too at 47 homers, 134 RBIs. And this is the day in 1991 that Mike Utley was paralyzed in a game against the Rams.
Ugh.
This day in sports. Go ahead, Bob. You want to bang
it's
out
time, it's,
a quick
it's
mailbag?
It's time for our mailbag. I don't know how quick it'll be. I like to make you squirm.
Well, so we'll see. I'll cut you off then. Thing, either okay? way, Brandon.
You're not cutting
signal,
me off, Brandon.
I give you
the
signal, Brandon. You cut his mic off. Go ahead.
That ain't
go
the
ahead.
Way we work. And the first thing is about Brandon. Damn it.
Go ahead.
And I want you guys to know you can tweet us. Not Eli. He's way too big now to be on Twitter. You can tweet us at UncleFred6 or at Bob Page Sports. And the Drew and Mike Show tweeted out their new extravaganza Monday with an interesting note saying Brandon straining to do some explaining. That's all they said. Brandon, what did that mean?
I was getting a lot of hell for missing a show because I did not have power. And
like that's your fault?
Well, they expected me to try to get into the studio and do the show anyway. However, I had to kind of stay home and take care of my own house and take care of my castle and take care of my family. And they didn't like that. So they right. threw some insults.
Wow, that's harsh.
All for fun. Go ahead. What else, Bob?
Really enjoyed talking to Danny Pohl, the great golfer out of Central Michigan, mid-Michigan, I should say, the other day. And reactions to that. Pat White, listener, says, I met Dan a few times. Great interview. Like others, sometimes I wish your interviews lasted longer. Paul Caron treated, great interview with Dan Pohl. How did he not end up at Central Michigan? Maybe because he doesn't like to play golf in the snow, Paul. That's all I'd say.
Yeah,
he also has a correction to what Larry Sorensen said about Gordie Howe Hockeyland being in St. Clair Shores, the first rink in the suburbs. They founded that, says Paul, so their kids, Mark and all the kids, didn't have to keep going to Canada to play games. Fraser Hockeyland actually was what came later. Now a decent three-rink facility. The Gordie Howe facility turned into a factory, Paul says, 20, 30 years ago, but legendary in St. Clair Shores history. That's where Paul's from. And the first sheet of real ice, a lot of kids like me played on and scored our first goals on too. Dave Jones says, I shook my head a bit when Denny in his Masters prediction said DeChambeau would struggle to make the cut, but great call, Denny. As DJ showed, it takes a complete game and full set of skills, not just a monster drive to be great. Quick compliment on Dan Pohl as a CMU student and a very avid golfer. It was always such a joy for me to play the Polecat course. Great course and worth the trip. You can contact us at asknofilter@gmail.com. Phil Reggio, originally of Clinton Township, now lives in Wilmington, Delaware, says, I started listening to your podcast back in March. I never miss a show, boys. The Essien interview, that's Jim Essien, was fantastic. Bob, you mentioned Jim's baseball and football prowess, but did you know Jim and St. Martin went to the Class D basketball state championship at Jenison Fieldhouse in 69. You also failed to mention that my dad, Phil Reggio, was a starting point guard on that team. Says he loved the Matt Shepard interview. Should have thought we should have given more kudos to Dick Enberg. I thought we did. And he also says, did you guys know that Mickey Mantle's 535th home run baseball, that was the one served up by Denny deliberately, just sold for $60,000? Huh. I didn't see that. Says keep up the great work and great interviews. Best show out there. Tom Bell from Chicago also says he loved the Dan Pohl, Mike Emmerich, and Jim Miller interviews. Mike Rizzo says, Bob, I love Eli, but him complaining about working 2 days a week and now only working one day is a bit tiresome. That's why you are the goat of No Filter, No Days Off Bob. Gross Point attorney and friend of the show, Norb Madison, says, and this is interesting. He says, I understand the negativity aimed at Jim Harbaugh. Frankly, the team looks to be in total disarray and he deserves the heat. But why is he taking so much abuse locally and nationally when James Franklin of Penn State doesn't seem to be attracting the same level of rancor? Preseason prognosticators had all picked Penn State and Michigan to be great. Now they're both 0-4 going nowhere. How come?
Well, we don't know. I haven't read that as much nationally, but Harbaugh certainly is the bigger name, the bigger hoopla, the bigger credentials.
Making $8 million.
Making $8 million a year. So when he's the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Yeah,
well, that's a great mailbag. We done with that? Are we done?
I'm not. I got one more, and I want your comments on this, and I think a lot of people would like to hear what you have to say about this, Eli. 760-89 balls is the number to call. And this is Keith. He's an avid listener to the show. He says he has two suggestions for future guests. One would be Helene St. James, the Wings beat writer for the Free Press.
Negative.
Book out.
Who else?
Called The Big 50. Are you in a hurry to go somewhere? Do you have to go to the bathroom?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, let me finish this, okay? Because I have something interesting to say about this. Apparently, this book she's written is about the 50 people in the history of the Wings who are most important up until current times. He says the book's fabulous. The other person he wants, and we've discussed this before, is Mike Hartman. Now, I think most of us know Mike Hartman, great guy, and at his level, terrific player. Detroit native, got a Stanley Cup ring with the New York Rangers, though he didn't play much. So consider this. Mike Camilleri of the University of Michigan, longtime NHL player. Mike Visor, the goalie. Matthew Schneider, very good defenseman for the Rangers and others. Jeff Halpern played almost 1,000 games
in the
NHL.
Who are these people you're talking about? Who are these people?
He's a journeyman. Zach Hyman of the Leafs, who also played at Michigan.
Why are you mentioning
Eric Nystrom played at Michigan and is in the NHL. Jack Hughes picked first overall. Why I'm mentioning this is this, because Mike obviously is Jewish. There has never been, think about this, a great Jewish hockey player. Now look at baseball, basketball, football. But never, the guys I just mentioned were obviously really good players. There's never been a great Jewish hockey player. You got any thoughts on why that is?
Not really, except that, I don't know, maybe there aren't a lot of Jews in Canada.
Well, we got a lot of them in the United States.
Well, but you mentioned it. And, you know, Quinn Hughes and his brother Jack Hughes, they'll break that
Jack
barrier.
Hughes.
So
so we'll see. Okay, I got nothing on that from you, Eli. I thought I might get some insight. So, Eli, guess what? Congratulations. The mailbag is over.
Thank you. And now let's talk to our special guest, John Miller. John Miller was one of the greatest players in Michigan high school football history. Helped the legendary Farmington Hills Harrison program to state titles his freshman and sophomore seasons. And in his career at Harrison, rushed for 4,500 yards, scored 30 touchdowns one season, finished his prep career with 20 interceptions, all still standing school records. But Miller's greatest day in football was October 10th, 1987, when the square jaw, 6'1", 195-pound defensive back intercepted a still standing Spartan record 4 passes against rival Michigan and quarterback Demetrius Brown.
Brown throw it again. Gets it away down the middle, intercepted. John Miller. Demetrius shoots it down the middle. It's intercepted. A very good play by John Miller. His second interception of the day. Miller watching Brown. Read his eyes. Read him all the way. Third down and 10. 3 wide outs. And Brown throwing. Passes away. Intercepted. That's Miller. John Miller has his third interception of the ball game with 26 seconds to go in the first half. Going to throw it again on first down to the sidelines. He throws another interception. John Miller has 4 interceptions in the ball game.
Amazing. But I'd like to point out, as we welcome John to the show, Michigan State only scored 17 points. What's that all about? 6 interceptions. All you guys score is 17 points. Of course, it was a great victory. And John, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Good to talk to you guys. Always love getting back to my Detroit roots.
Does it seem like yesterday when you caught those 4 passes, John? And have you ever had a better day in football?
Oh, come on, Freddie.
Well, you know what? I had some pretty good days in at Farmington Hills Harrison that I'm pretty proud of. So
yeah, you had 6 touchdowns and 287 yards in one game.
Yeah, but this was the Big Ten.
I know it.
Hey, John, you know, I mentioned this at the top of the show, and Eli alluded to it in passing. When you consider the fact that you were such a great player on both sides of the ball at Farmington Harrison, you look at the history of high school football in the state of Michigan and all the great, great players. You might be the single greatest high school football player the state ever produced.
Oh my goodness. All around. What's he supposed to say to that?
That's very nice to say, but, you know, honestly, when I got to know a lot of the guys when I went away to Michigan State, I saw what real true athletes looked like. And, you know, guys like Andre Rison, who I'm like, how in the heck did I beat this guy out for the number one player in the state? So I give a lot of that credit in terms of my abilities to play football to a couple different groups of people. Certainly, I was the youngest of six kids, and I took a brutal beating growing up, which just continuously made me stronger and better and faster and mentally tougher. And then you go to a school like Farmington Hills Harrison, and you have some of the greatest coaches in John Harrington and Bob Sutter, and you play with some great, great traditional type people, and it grows on you. It makes you a better football player and a better person all around. And I owe a lot of people that credit.
John, I read that you were running sprints with the players at Farmington Hills Harrison when you were 7 or 8 years old. You were being groomed to be a Harrison football player. Is that true?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely true. But again, I was the youngest of four boys, and all three of my older brothers were captains at Harrison and major contributors to the success before I got there in terms of building the tradition at Harrison. So as a young kid, yeah, I carried water bottles and absolutely loved being out there. And guys like John Harrington, enabled me to do that and made me a part of that program long before I got there. So. Again, it certainly wasn't all me. There's a lot of credit that goes to those individuals.
You know, you ran for almost 4,500 yards, like I said. You are big. You're 6'1", 195 also. But you went to Michigan State and didn't play and didn't run the ball. Obviously, they had Lorenzo White and others. Did you consider going somewhere else where you could have been a star running back as well? Was that, or did you think you would be allowed to run the ball when Michigan State took you?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew in my heart that playing defense was for me. I always wanted to be the person that brought the hit to somebody, not accepted the hit. So, defense was always in my heart. It was a passion that I had. I loved it. And every university that recruited me let me make the decision. I could have either played offense or defense. And there was never any doubt that I was going to be a defensive player, especially when you go play for a guy like George Perlis. You know, that was in his roots as the Steel Curtain coach, and playing defense for a guy like that only made sense for me. And never, ever question that. Now, when George Perlis put me back to return punts my junior year, now that I question. Especially when you had a guy like Andre Rison standing on the sidelines and coach yells at me to get in there. And for the last 2 years of my career, I returned punts. I'm not sure that was the smartest decision George Perlis ever made, but I certainly enjoyed being back there.
Well, Bo wanted you too.
Yeah, I was going to ask him, why didn't you go to Michigan?
What tilted you to Michigan State, John?
Well, you know, if people always ask you that because – the final five schools I really came down to was Notre Dame, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, and Michigan State. And I believe all four of those other schools were vying for national championship contention really at that point in time. And I picked Michigan State. And I tell people all the time, for me, it wasn't picking one of the universities. I picked George Perlis. And he was a great man. Absolutely loved him. I knew I wanted to play for George when I first met him. And listen, all those other guys that came into my home, they were bigger than life characters. You know, my family absolutely loves them. And to be honest with you, I think my parents wanted me to go to Michigan. They fell in love with Bo Schembechler. But there was just something about George Perlis that when I met him, I knew that that was the guy that I wanted to play for.
And you had the last laugh because Bo always got the criticism about being unable to win the Rose Bowl. You did win the Rose Bowl. I was there covering that game, and so was Fred Heumann.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I'm really proud of that because, you know, when George Perlis came into Michigan State, he promised Spartan Nation he would get us back to the Rose Bowl in a certain period of time. And I was one of the guys that helped do that for all of Spartan Nation and lived up to George Perlis's promise to everybody. So for me, that was very special. And, you know, for everybody who got to go out to Pasadena and be at the Rose Bowl, that was an electrifying year, an electrifying time in Spartan lore era. And to be a part of that, I was very, very proud. And it's something I'll always share with me.
We had we've had a bunch of Michigan. In fact, we've had two of your teammates on the show. We've had Lorenzo White and we had Todd Crum. But I found what's interesting. We also had some Michigan guys talking about when Bo Schembechler finally won the Rose Bowl in 81. You guys won it 7 years later. They had started that season 1-2 and then really turned it around. Same thing happened to you guys in 87. You started 1-2. You lost badly to Notre Dame and I think really badly to Florida State. No one would have thought you could end 9-2-1. You ran the table except for a tie after that. What turned that team around?
Well, you know, of course, Notre Dame and Florida State were pretty good football teams. But we went into Iowa, and actually I think we were losing at halftime. And George Perlis gave maybe the most inspirational speech I've ever heard in my life at halftime of that game. And he didn't hold back, and he called out individuals on that team. I was one of them at halftime. And he said, we're either going to do this now, we're going to do it together, or it's never going to happen. And there was just something about that game that sparked us. And that's when our defense really came to light. I mean, we ended up putting an absolute pounding on the rest of the Big Ten defensively the rest of that season. And when it came down to the end playing USC, we really felt that we probably could have competed with anybody on the field because of our defense. It took our offense a while to gain traction, but once we figured out that Lorenzo was going to carry the ball 30, 40, and 50 times a game, and Bobby McAllister was electrifying in certain games with Andre Rison and Willie Boyer. It was amazing what we were able to do. And you guys, you know, our offensive line that year was fantastic with Tony Mandarich. And, you know, it took us a few games to figure out who we were. But once we did, we really never looked back. And probably one of the greatest teams at Michigan State.
You know, John, as memorable as that Rose Bowl was for you and for me and for Bob who covered it, I've covered a lot of football at Michigan State because my career took me from Detroit and then Lansing, as you know, for 18 years. But the game that I'll never forget is you beating Indiana that day with Blake Ezor running crazy and Lorenzo White carrying the ball like 48 times and the defense shutting down and the mob scene. This was back before, as you know, the walls at Spartan Stadium, you could step over them and run on the field. And that mob scene after that game in the final minutes of Indiana – and then Bill Mallory coming into your locker room and saying, hey, I'm damn proud of you, and go out and kick their ass in the Rose Bowl because we're proud of you at the Big Ten. I've never remembered a day like that. That must have been a fabulous memory for you too, the Indiana game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we just played Indiana here this past week. But that week brings back a lot of great memories. Obviously, that's when we clinched the Rose Bowl. And you're right, that mob scene was unbelievable. Honestly, it was scary. I mean, if you got on that field and it was almost like a huge wave. I remember actually picking up a kid who looked like he was, you know, 4 or 5 years old, who I think kind of lost his parents, but it was scary out there because it was like the mob just kind of carried you wherever you wanted to go. I didn't care how big you were. you couldn't get through it. So it became a little bit frightening, but it was exciting. And then you're exactly right. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like Coach Mallory coming into our locker room. They played that speech on social media somewhere. And I tell you, it brought tears in my eyes and it got me fired up listening to Coach Mallory talk about going out and beating USC. And it just showed that the Big Ten was due. And I felt that the rest of the Big Ten knew we had a team to go out there and do it. And, you know, it was about time. And that's exactly what we did.
You know, from such high points, John, in your football career to the nadir of your football career, you're sentenced to a prison sentence playing for your hometown Detroit Lions. What was that like?
Well, you know, I always say that it was a dream come true. But honestly, you know, growing up, it was never a dream of mine to go play professional football. It's just part of the process, and it happened. But I do remember going to Thanksgiving Day games growing up and to actually be able to go and play in a couple of those games and have my family come down on Thanksgiving and watch me play. And I remember my friends from college and high school also coming down and cheering me on, you know, from the stands. That was always extremely, extremely exciting. That's something I'll never forget. I wish it could have lasted longer. I felt like it could have lasted longer. But you know, you're right. You know, always be a Lions fan, always be a Detroit fan. But it gets pretty depressing, you know, after a period of time. And when, you know, I never want to criticize a coach ever, but when you have a guy like Barry Sanders on your team, and, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, you're still running the run and shoot. There's a problem with coaching, I think, at that point in time.
Well, can I take that one step further, John? And this is a story I heard, and I've never substantiated with you, so you can do what you want with this. I heard that after in training camp, you were with the Lions, and you were told you were going to play in the final preseason game and get your chance to make that team. And I was told you didn't play a down in that game. And at midnight, this coaches came in from the bar, stumbling drunk, and you thought to yourself, these guys are going to determine my future, and you never played in that game, and I don't think you played again for the Lions. Is there any truth to that?
Well, yeah, there's absolutely a lot of truth to that. The first part of what you said, yeah, they indicated that was going to be my opportunity to really make the team, And you know, I was of course very excited, nervous, you know, emotional. And I remember taking a walk that night outside the team hotel, and that's exactly what I saw out in the parking lot. Of course, they didn't see me. You know, so that's a little bit disheartening when, you know, everything that you're working for happens. It just so happens that I actually did get placed on the developmental squad, and then I was activated at some point in time after that. But irregardless, yeah, that's a little bit disheartening when you know that those are the individuals that have your future in their hands. So a lot of truth to that. I'm not sure how you even found out about that, but absolutely a lot of truth to that story.
Wow. Well, those are actually candid.
Those actually somewhat decent Lion teams, that because the 91 team that you didn't make was one of the better ones they had. But, you know, that's depressing. As you're telling the Mallory story, and as you're talking about George Perlis and the halftime speech against Iowa, I'm getting chills. And I was I'm a Michigan guy, you know, and now we see Michigan where they play with no emotion. Nobody can understand what's happened to that team. It's some reflection on Harbaugh and his inability to make them believe and be motivated. And I'm thinking of Perlis. Talk about the emotion that can take place where you can turn a season around or whatever on a halftime speech. They always downplay that it only lasts a minute or two, a fiery speech, but you're saying that maybe as kids, you could, it would just send chills through you and change the way you played.
There's no question about it. I mean, you know, once you get up into the professional ranks, you know, I think the emotional piece, you know, kind of withdraws itself a little bit. You know, you're a professional and you're expected to play like a professional. But when you're, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, you just came out of high school, you know, the emotional factor is huge. It's funny, you know, my son Grayson, who played at Michigan State, you know, you used to tell me when his team went in to play the Buckeyes, I think in 2015 or 16, we went down there and played them and clinched our chance to go to the Big Ten Championship. You know, I just remember him saying when Michigan State came out at halftime, he goes, our team was so fired up. He says, we looked over to the other sidelines and we could tell the emotion on the other sidelines was at a negative level. There was no emotion. And he said, we knew as a team we were going to win that football game that day just by looking at the other team. So it's there. It's huge. You know, it kind of goes to all the gimmicks that a lot of these teams are doing right now with the fumble chains and slamming basketballs in baskets that after an interception. You know, I think a lot of that stuff is gimmicky, but it boils down to it fires up team members and it gets your teammates fired up. It gets those individuals who maybe aren't in the football game playing, it gets them more involved into the game. It gets them a little bit more fired up. And there's no doubt there's an emotional piece to football that will never go away, but especially when you're talking about that collegiate level. And you have a guy like George Perlis. And you know, coaches are all different, but George Perlis, I think you heard that tribute they had to him the other day. He talked about that constantly. He talked about being tough. And if you were tough, you were going to win. And that wasn't just something he said. You know, when it came down to George Perlis, if he knew he had 22 guys on the field that were tougher than the other team, you know, we might not have been better athletes. You know, on that Rose Bowl team, I think there were 12 or 14 starters on that Rose Bowl team that weren't recruited by another Big Ten team. And he used that as a motivational tool to inspire people to say, listen, these guys didn't want you. I did, because you're tough and I want to go out and I want street fighters. They're going to be on the field. And if we go out at the 50-yard line and we got to throw down and throw our helmets to the ground and fight this other team, you're the 22 guys I want. And that inspires kids. That fires you up. And trust me, I just got to say,
because being in the media, and I really like George Perlis. I was close with George Perlis. I introduced him at a couple of events, I recall. But to the media, he was so boring. He would say, well, just play hard and keep your mouth shut and good things will happen. He would say, oh, and yet, of course, he's a different, just like Mark D'Antonio was so dry and droll with the media. But I guess behind closed doors, when it's just him and the team, a different side of the personality comes out. Very, yeah. Very insightful and interesting.
Yeah. Well, John, you're talking about emotion like this. I did not see any emotion from your alma mater, which is my alma mater too, of course, last Saturday against Indiana. And I wonder what you make of this whole Michigan State mess, starting with Nassar, going to the way Mark D'Antonio left the program, the kerfuffle over bringing in Mel Tucker, and now what's happened to the football team this year. It was looking up when they beat Michigan, but now we know how awful a mess Michigan is.
Yeah, well, you know, first off, when you start, you know, the entire conversation, you brought up Nassar. Of course, just a complete black eye against the university and sports in general, and certainly to the survivors and the fighters through all that. My heart goes out to them. You know, and that has nothing to do with what's happening, you know, today. You know, and listen, I love the staff that's in there. And I've got some guys on that staff that are still very close to me, some of my very close friends, Harlan Barnett and Tressel and Burton, guys from the old staff that I became very close with, and of course played with Harlan. So this isn't a coaching issue. And I think that Coach Tucker is the right guy. I love his enthusiasm. I love his emotion. I love what he's doing from a recruiting standpoint. But you got to remember, you know, this team is their spring practice. You know, this team didn't get to go through spring ball together with an entirely new staff, a new system in place, offensively and defensively. They're still learning who each other are and actually still trying to figure out who are the right guys to put on the field. So that's, you know, that, first of all, that's number one. Secondly, yeah, you know, you've got to be able to bring emotion. You saw what emotion can do in that Michigan game. Irregardless of what condition Michigan's in right now, you know, that game never mattered who was number one in the country, two in the country, 10 in the country, or not rated in the country. That game was all based on emotion, and Michigan State brought the emotion to that game that day. And that's the type of thing that Coach Tucker, from a cultural standpoint, is trying to bring to this team every single game. You can't just bring that in the Michigan game. You got to bring it against Indiana. You got to bring it against Iowa. Teams will go out there and they will whoop your butt if you don't bring the emotion with you. And I think Coach Tucker is the guy to do that. I personally do not know Coach Tucker. I haven't met him. But everything that I've seen, everything that I've read about him, I think he's the right guy for our program. I think he came at the right time. I just felt that Coach D, when he came to our program, was the right guy. But there were so many things going against Coach D at the end of his career with regards to the whole Nassar deal, the issues that were going on internally to the team. I think it was probably the right time for him to step back and say, you know what, somebody else has got to take this over. And as a Spartan fan, I think we all really knew that we were probably looking at a 2 to 3 year turnaround until we could get back to winning 10, 11, 12 games and taking over and having a chance to win the Big Ten. So, you know, a lot of this doesn't surprise me. It will surprise me in by the end of this season, if we don't see that emotion kicking up. But I think Mel's the guy to do that. And I'm still excited about Michigan State football, always have been. And I think we're in the right place. And
Makes one of us, John, if you're so excited about Michigan State football.
Be fair.
You got to remember, I picked Michigan State in a pretty down period. So I'm always inspired by what can happen in the green and white, and it doesn't take much. You know, hey, basketball season's coming in 9 days. That always gives me something to root for, but it also still makes me reflect on what happens in the football season, and I'm always fired up for it.
Well, John, it was great to hear you reflect on the past. Those are some glorious days. We didn't even talk about Harrison that much. I know you still talk with John Harrington, who made that program and is in.
And the school's gone. That broke John Miller's heart and everybody else's heart. School's gone.
Great to relive it with you. Thanks for joining us, and continued good luck. I know you're working in the automobile business down in, is it Indiana or Illinois? Where are you? Kentucky, right?
Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay.
We're down. Hey, you guys want to hear a quick story about, you know, we talked a little, if you got a minute, I'd love to tell you this story.
Sure.
This isn't a story I've told too many people. You know, your football career has gone full circle when, after I was done playing for the Lions, remember I went and played for the Birmingham Fire, and I loved playing for the Birmingham Fire. That was a great way to end my career. But a lot of people don't know, after I got released by Detroit, that following season I got an opportunity to go out to Phoenix's camp, and I went to Phoenix, the Cardinals, and I got out there, and we were 2 weeks into camp. And I didn't see the field one time after 2 weeks. Coach Bugle was the head coach out there. So I went and talked to him, and I said, hey, listen, the whole reason for camp is to get reps to see if he can play. I've been here for 2 weeks, haven't seen the field yet. And he looked at me and he says, does that mean you're going to quit? And I said, listen, I'm here to play. I'm here to compete. You're not giving me that opportunity. So, yeah, I'd like you to release me so I can go somewhere else. He said, we're not going to release you. I said, okay. So I go out to the practice field. I'm warming up. I'm stretching in front of 100 other players. Their general manager comes up to me and he says, hey, we are going to grant you release. So that way I had to walk off the field in front of the entire team and kind of humiliate myself and walk out of there. Well, then I had to get a ride home to the Phoenix airport. We were up in Flagstaff. That was an hour and a half drive. I had to actually, you guys are going to love this. I actually had to flag down a U.S. mail truck that delivered mail to the football players on that campus every day, and threw my stuff in the back of a U.S. mail truck. And that guy gracefully drove me back to Phoenix so I could catch an airplane back to Detroit. Wow. To get out of Phoenix. So I knew at that point in time, I'm riding the back of a mail truck with all my football gear that I said, I think my career has gone full circle. Maybe I ought to go look for something else to do.
Maybe you should have become an Uber driver, John. That was a
problem. Yeah, I don't know. By then. That was the end of my career. So.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of careers don't end the way you dreamed. It's sad, and you're not the only one, but we certainly sympathize with that. We certainly enjoyed watching you when you were here, both in high school and college, and thank you again for joining us today, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Thanks.
Hey, thank you, guys. Always my pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Sure thing. Bye-bye. Yeah. I think we also need to mention Grayson, because people want to know about Grayson, his son who played at Michigan. He's in coaching now, isn't he? Didn't you say he's a graduate assistant
at Ohio State. Yeah.
Cool. I don't like that place in particular, but good for him. And we wish him the best of luck.
Good guy, Johnny.
Good to see Freddie. You're going to see you on Thursday. Eli, we want to see you on Thursday too. But we'll see who's going to be on the show. You never know, folks.
So long, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Have a great week.
We watch you listen.